Welcome to the Industrial Talk Podcast with Scott McKenzie. Scott is a passionate industry professional dedicated to transferring cutting-edge, industry-focused innovations and trends while highlighting the men and women who keep the world moving. So put on your hard hat, grab your work boots, and let's go.
My goodness, what a week. Last week, I was broadcasting live from the IMC 2017 Reliability Conference. That was brought to you by the wonderful and incredible people with ReliabilityWeb.com. They put on a stellar show. Highly recommend it. Highly encourage you to find out more about ReliabilityWeb.com. Of course, they're out there because they're ReliabilityWeb.com. But man, I got to tell you, man, incredible people. They put on quite the show, the conference, great networking. If there's anything negative about it, I can't find it because it was a spectacular time. We were down in Bonita Springs and surrounded by a ton of reliability industry leaders, thought leaders, you name it. They were down there and they were all talking about reliability, asset management, all of the good stuff that keeps that asset rolling. Hi there, I'm Scott McKenzie with Industrial Talk. I'm so glad that you are here. I am the voice of industry. I am your industrial cheerleader. We like to provide that education, that information that keeps those companies and people moving forward. I really appreciate you being here. Like I said, I was broadcasting live from IMC 2017, and I got to tell you, man, I've been a part of a lot of conferences. That one was just right at the top because they do a fantastic job, and if you need to find out more about reliability and get that knowledge in you, I got to tell you, that's the place to go. I've got my coffee in hand, and I'm ready to get this this week's podcast going. I was, unfortunately, because I was at the conference, I was not able to produce the other last week's podcast from Industrial Talk, but that's okay because those fine people at Reliability Web have given us the opportunity to be able to provide incredible content for a long time. Now, this week's podcast, and it's going to be a two-parter. The gentleman is named Jack Nicholas. Now, Jack Nicholas has a storied, wonderful, incredible background in just the reliability space. He has been given the Lifetime Achievement Award from Reliability Web, and that was this past week. And he's a published author of 12 books in the reliability area, and definitely a thought leader, definitely a trailblazer. And so just bear with the being live at the IMC conference and listen to this gentleman, because if you have any desire to know what reliability is all about, get his books. Seek him out in LinkedIn, because he's out there and he is a open book. He is a wealth of knowledge. And I'm just honored. Gosh darn it. I'm honored to be able to have this opportunity to meet with him. But first off, I want to make sure that you understand that conference had wonderful people. So consider going to the conference next year. And I think there's one also in Las Vegas. But just go out to the reliabilityweb.com location. Find out information about it, because I got to tell you, you will not be disappointed. So without further ado, I give you a gentleman by the name of Jack Nicholas. It was an honor for me. He is an incredible person. This will be broken up into two parts. The second part will be more about his background, where he came from, and it will be led by a gentleman by the name of Buddy Lee. And enjoy the podcast, and thank you once again for joining the Industrial Talk podcast. And here is Mr. Jack Nicholas. All right, welcome back to the Industrial Talk podcast. We are live from IMC 2017, and we're going to continue our conversation with Mr. Jack Nicholas. He is a trailblazer, a leader in the reliability space, and absolutely a published author. I think you've got 10 books out there.
12.
Boy, I even shortchanged you on the books. My gosh, 12. I'm fortunate enough to read one a year, so. But I'm impressed, and if there's anything that's reliability-related this is the gentleman that knows it, who's lived through it, and definitely knows what he's talking about. Mr. Jack, we're going to be specifically talking about your book. You got a new book out called Asset Conditioning and Monitoring Management. Hey, can you give sort of like a little overview of what that book means?
Well, basically, the book deals with what we used to call predictive maintenance. And it's actually a successor to a series of books that went through three editions that was called Predictive Maintenance Management. But in the past few years, what's happened is we've changed the terminology due to the issuance of ISO 55000, the asset management standards from Geneva, Switzerland, which were a multinational, like I think 37 country combined effort to produce these standards that were successors to the British standard 55. The book deals more exclusively with asset condition monitoring, if you will, and, or predictive maintenance. I use them interchangeably in the book.
So there really isn't a, I mean, in my background, it's always been somewhat the predictive maintenance world where I'm trying to predict a condition on an asset, failure, whatever it might be. So asset conditioning, monitoring, management is similar.
Roughly the same thing. But what I try to deal with in this book is the management aspect of it. In other words, you're dealing with high-tech tools. There are probably two dozen right now available in the commercial world. And the simplest and earliest ones, probably vibration analysis and then infrared thermography, lubrication, whirl particle analysis, ultrasonic analysis, and motor testing, which is a specialty of mine. But when you try to put these things together in one group or in an organization, it requires a different set of management skills than ordinary maintenance personnel have. So you need to teach them how to balance the technology with the training and the personnel requirements that you need to have to make the program the best possible it can be. And unfortunately, what's been proven with a couple of surveys that have been done by Plant Services Magazine in the past 4 years is that the majority of these programs don't work out very well. The people who have been surveyed clearly indicate that only about 17% are really totally satisfied with their programs. Whereas roughly
the predictive maintenance program.
Yes. And roughly 60% clearly indicate their program needs some improvement. The rest are somewhat in between. They're satisfactory, but they might not be getting all of what they could be getting out of a full-blown, well-sourced or resourced program that's got the support of everybody in the organization. Which is another aspect of management of it. They do make mistakes on occasion, and sometimes they take a hit for that, but for the most part, what they're able to do with this predictive maintenance or asset condition monitoring is give you advance warning of the onset of failures of equipment. When you have the onset, you have the opportunity to plan and schedule repairs on a basis that you control, rather than the equipment telling you by failing completely that it needs help.
Right. I mean, I'm gonna back up a little bit there, Mr. Jack, and you touched upon, I think it was like 20 some odd tools.
Yes.
And I what comes to mind is that I've got this, you know, backpack full of tools, of these predictive tools that can truly help a company. What I would see being a challenge is how do you use each one to the fullest potential, but how do you prioritize? Is it, like vibration or thermo or whatever? You know, once a company gets a hold of all of these things, I would imagine it's pretty challenging to say, okay, now it's time to do this, now it's time to do that, and so on and so forth.
Well, every failure mode, and you can identify failure modes with a methodology that's called reliability-centered maintenance, mm-hmm. which is well written up in many, many books. I have one of them.
Of course you do, because you got 12.
Well, give you the basics on how to identify failure modes and the consequences of ignoring them. With each failure mode, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, there's some technology that can give you an advance warning through the onset of the failure through some indicator. It may be a parameter, a pressure gauge, vibration signature, some heat or lack of heat indication in a machine or on a machine that tells you something's different than it should be. And with these various tools, no one of which can detect all the failure modes for any given equipment, you need a tool bag, if you will, a combination of tools in order to get through all of the failure modes that can occur. So that's why you need to have more than just one. And you, with increased sophistication, you get more and more advanced warning and indication of the nature of the failure that's occurring so that you can plan for its replacement. For example, if you have a bearing that's going bad, now you know you need a replacement bearing. But if you can get it early enough, you will not have any collateral damage, because the bearing, if it starts spinning, will damage the end bell of a motor, for example, that is held in. And you don't want to have to make that repair. You just want to replace the bearing. So that's why you do vibration analysis. But the earlier indication of vibration analysis is ultrasonic. It's simply a higher frequency indicator of noise from that particular component, that bearing. And you can't hear it with your ears because it's ultrasonic. It's above the 20,000 hertz, roughly, maximum frequency that most people can hear at. But then when it gets down into the hearing range, you want to get some quantification of that and use a vibration analysis tool to give you more specific information concerning that bearing, that, and also to distinguish it from a misalignment or some other defect that can cause a machine to vibrate. So you know exactly what you have to do early enough to be able to plan for the corrective action that needs to be taken.
The question I have is, let's just take that from a that point of vibration. You know, you've got this motor. Okay, it's a motor. It's one of many different types of motors, right? And you're saying, okay, this has a vibration. It has an ultrasonic versus whatever. Are there any standards of saying, hey, that motor has, yeah, that's a typical signature from a vibration point of view, that motor. But if that vibration signature was over here on this motor, that's not good. Do they have sort of like, I mean, gosh, or is it one and the same?
Well, there's all kinds of references on the subject of vibration analysis, and many of them include graphs that give you levels of vibration versus severity of the vibration. And once you use those, they're very simple, using overall vibration levels. You can make a good call. If you get into more detail with a specific frequency that's associated with a specific bearing, you can make the call more accurately and more precisely. You can't necessarily in every case tell how much longer that bearing is going to last, but at least you know you got a bad bearing. And if now you can plan for it. If you have the bearing in stock and it's easy to get to, that's fine. But if you have to order it, you may have to fly it in using FedEx or
some other, that bad boy.
And that adds to the cost of
Absolutely.
The repair. The earlier you can make that plan for the repair, the less expensive it's going to be, the less collateral damage that is likely to occur, and the overall smarter your organization is in doing that.
Now, your book, I'm a company, and I'm really interested in reading that book, and your book takes you, a step-by-step of how me as a company would be able to set up this management structure, this asset conditioning management structure, but it's step by step?
It is. It starts off with just the philosophy, the objectives and goals of a asset condition monitoring program. And then we talk about the functions that are performed by the people who are actually conducting the program. And then I give examples of alternatives to the various ways of doing this. And the alternatives range from one to about four. I call them levels or hierarchy. The simplest is to use very simple tools that are easy to learn. You get the information on the internet or with the accompanying documentation, a vibration meter, an infrared thermography gun. You can now buy a infrared sensor that you can link up to iPhone.
No way, really?
Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you, the future's bright, man. It's things like that. That's
but
great.
Very simple. It won't tell you everything you'd like to know, but it will tell you that you've got a problem. And there are other sensors, like ultrasonic sensors, that you can link up to an iPad, for example. Mm-hmm. You can also use the analytics that are put into an iPad to do laser alignment of machinery.
Yep, yep.
So we're coming to an era where the cost of these tools, which are no longer really specialty tools, they are common use tools that you can use with common computer-based instrumentation and software. But that's at the very basic level. You want to go a little higher in sophistication with a lot more information, the ability to store data, recall it, compare it, trend analyze it, use statistical analysis on it, and other things. There are about six different analysis methods that can be applied locally. You can learn a lot about the machine and the progress that it's making towards a failure. So you generally take people who have vibration analysis skills, infrared thermography skills, ultrasonic skills, motor testing skills, and you put them into a team. That's the second level of the organizational arrangement that I describe here.
Right.
Then you'll go outside the program because you need training. Sometimes you need mentoring. Sometimes you need a temporary replacement for a member of your team that might have been hurt in an automobile accident or something of that
right.
nature.
Right.
So you get to a contractor that can provide those services. And other training such as visual test and inspection, which is a very vital adjunct to any of the technology tools that you have. And then also on that third level, what's coming is use of the Internet of Things. With the
everybody, it's like the buzz here today,
yeah.
or at this conference.
It's coming.
It's a buzz, baby.
And anybody who's not aware of it and starting to learn how to use it is going to fall behind in competition. So you
when
need
you say
to have somebody.
Just real quick, it just the adoption and embracing, but from a competition point of view, you just better be in it or nobody's going to look at you.
Yeah, but you have to do it a smart way.
Yeah.
I've written a paper that says what people in the maintenance reliability business have to do to prepare themselves to take on the use of the Internet and these advanced analytics and cloud computing and all those things. That paper talks about my background in condition monitoring in the early days on nuclear submarines from 1971 to 1988. It really started to take off much better in the 90s when we got laptop computers.
Yep.
Instead of the big clunky ones that we used to have.
Right, right.
Or build ourselves in our case, in the case of PDMA Corporation.
See, you can say that in a sentence. I could never say build myself. I was like, no, forget it.
Well, I didn't, but I had some very smart people who did. And with software programs that are very innovative, easy to use and understand and apply. So you get into this situation where you need help with that because you generally don't have that kind of knowledge inside most organizations
you
in
don't.
The maintenance and reliability period. So you need another contractor to help you there, and ultimately you're going to have a contract with somebody who can provide those services. And you're going to do some things in the cloud. You're going to do most of the things, ideally, on site with your own tools that you have, and with even artificial intelligence can help you understand the nature of the failures that are occurring with the information that you can put into the algorithms. So we're coming to a new level. But back on the book, I've tied this to ISO 55000, the asset management thing, standard that comes out of Geneva, Switzerland, and indicate the impact that the asset condition monitoring, or the lack of it, would have at each stage of the life cycle of an organization, from the very early design stage, or even the concept stage before that, through to the installation stage, the operations and maintenance stage, and even decommissioning stage of an asset. I'll talk about all of that. And then
just briefly, do you also touch upon, somebody was talking about brownfield.
Yeah, the brownfield means existing plants.
That's right.
Greenfield should be
brand new,
internet ready.
That's right, but your book also does it address brownfield and saying, okay, I got an existing, I want to do this, I got an existing asset, I want to apply these principles, boom.
It does from the standpoint of the second level of the program that I outlined.
Right.
That's using the handheld tools that you carry
that's
around.
Right.
when we're talking about Internet of Things, it doesn't quite have that. A paper that I wrote does. And I may incorporate that in the next edition of the book. But
because you have 12 and you can do that, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, that's right. And then what I try to outline is key performance indicators that you should use to determine whether your program is working or not. You have to be honest about this. And you put it on economic terms, dollars and cents.
It's always dollars and cents.
That's what the C-level people understand.
Absolutely.
That's what's going to make your program survive or not survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I have outlined how you should build a various KPIs. I give examples of KPIs that have been used in the past by successful organizations in this business. And then the most important chapter, in my opinion, is the chapter on having a master plan for asset condition monitoring. The most successful programs that have gotten awards here at the International Maintenance Conference are the ones that had a detailed plan and followed the plan and kept it up to date. And every year they would update the plan for the next 5 years that they anticipated being in operation. So the master plan has a whole bunch of boilerplate stuff up front, including an executive summary, which other than the budget that's in the plan is the only thing the C-level people are going to read.
Yes.
And the rest of it's for the people who are actually going to carry out the program.
Yeah.
And their successors, which is very important.
Yeah, I was going to tell you, because there's a lot of churn, just churn in business, and you got this plan, and the plan to a certain extent can be considered a static document. It does evolve and change and change as a result of business changes, but it's still, you're still moving down the path. Does the book also address, hey, you better have backup on this, and you, I mean, because there's just going to be change, whether we like it or not.
Absolutely. And I indicate the evolution of a plan would, for example, require you to change it as you learn, maybe four times the first year, two times the next year, and at least annually after that. So plans are very important, because plans give you gravitas. They give you credibility. They allow you to go to people from whom you need support, like from the IT people or contracts personnel or the human resources people. And if they know you've got a plan, whether they read it or not, they know you've got something that's more stable that they can rely upon if they really need to read any part of it.
Right.
And they'll do more for you than if you don't have anything.
And if you are disciplined in your plans and you can, you, they know that, hey, there's an active effort to keep it up to date, change, but keep it current so that it's relevant today.
And also, one of the things I recommend putting in the plan is the history of the program as it's evolving. So at least every year,
right,
you should update to say the following things happened this year in terms of new equipment we purchased or new software we added.
Right.
Here's what it cost when we bought it this time, so you have a comparison for next time. My recommendation, because it changes so often, is that all the equipment, the technology, should be upgraded at least every 5 years. And you're going to be forced to upgrade in any case, because Windows is going to come out with a Windows 11 to replace Windows 10 or something of that nature.
You're right about that, yeah.
And the software programs have to change with it.
You
have to budget for
those. And that's with the tools as well.
The tools change because of electronics.
Yeah.
Having been in the business of building motor testers, I can tell you that the average life cycle of a motherboard, for example, or a complicated electronics board is about 18 months. About 18 months, they're not going to have that in stock anymore. You're going to have to buy another model, and you're going to have to accommodate that new model in whatever design you've got for your motor tester or anything else.
18 months. It's like millennials.
It's
the millennial motherboards.
but it's today's world. It's the way things work today.
Wow.
You've got to accommodate it. And then I talk about recommendations for strengthening all components of a program. If you have an existing program, I've got 20 recommendations for further improving it. This is also sort of a desk reference book. The original book that I wrote was just addressed the technologies themselves. That's now an appendix.
No kidding.
So I describe the technologies. I bring them up to date. There are a couple of new things that are here. at the conference that I addressed in the book that people wouldn't know about otherwise. And so this desk reference, there's like 65 different technologies that I talk about, or different aspects of this, or variations of technologies. So it's a substantial appendix to the document. In addition, what I put in here is an audit package that allows you to audit up to 10 technologies that I've identified, the most common technologies that I see in use today.
And for the listeners out there, when you say technologies, what do you mean? Just give an example.
Like vibration analysis, infrared tomography, ultrasonics, lubricant wear particle analysis, motor testing, that thing. So that you could take this audit and do the audit yourself. It's got a scoring mechanism to it. And then you can add up all the scores, and you can determine whether you're in the world class of program or at the bottom end, a program that needs some support and work.
If I was an IT professional and all of this technology is coming out, and would my head explode? In addition to all the other things that I have to be responsible for in the world of technology?
Well, I think if you're an IT specialist, this book would be of no interest or value to you. You have to be in the business of condition monitoring. You have to know the machinery.
In the management of these
tools.
The tools are saying, hey, I need up because I've got 18 months on this bad boy, I'm going to upgrade it, I'm going to change it, I'm going to do it. Is it recommended within your book that that organization within the reliability have its own real technology, or is that something that's sort of sheltered out to the IT group?
More or less sheltered out to the IT group, but you have to have them on your side. They have to understand what your needs are, and at least understand that you're serious about your needs. And you have to have enough clout with C-level people to have a priority for them to act in your behalf.
So, and here's the funny thing. So I've been in other companies, and let's just say they purchase a tool, a thermography, right? So it comes in this beautiful case, and it's all wonderful, and it's got a pretty high price tag. And then some guy's going to go, and the company says, you're blessed, and you're going to go out and you're going to learn how to use that tool, and then you're going to go out and you're going to get trained, and then you're going to come back and you're going to be this representative. And I'm telling you, more often than not, that individual is then gone. Go some other place in the organization, and there sits the tool because they don't have the backup to be able to say, oh, it's still a valuable tool, and then it just sits there, and then it goes out. This whole management, it has to be embraced. It's a real cultural thing.
Well, I address retention and succession. Try to get these people who have an interest in it to sort of line up to become part of the team, for example. Once you're on the team, then the question is, are you going to support them at just level one certification, or are you going to let them go to level two? Or maybe even a third level on some of the technologies that can add to their expertise in applying the technologies. In my opinion, most people can go to level two and provide all the resources or all the talent that's necessary for almost any organization. But some of the bigger ones require level three personnel, as defined, for example, by the American Society for Non-Destructive Testing, which addresses vibration analysis, infrared tomography, and visual testing or visual inspection, in addition to the normal non-destructive testing technologies such as magnetic particle and dipenetrant testing and other technologies of that nature.
So you've been coming to this conference for many years. You've seen it change. You've seen it evolve. You've recognized the changes that have taken place within the reliability space and the technology that's coming. Where do you see sort of this future going? If you had your, if you put your special glasses on and you're looking into the future, where do you see this reliability world going?
Well, the problem is that not enough people have adopted reliability practices, and they still have a great need for them. They just don't even know it. Or they don't want to take the time for it, or they're not given the resources
necessary.
And
that's the challenge, too. That's the big challenge.
That's right. The methodology that leads to the best reliability program we have right now starts with what's called reliability-centered maintenance. That's been practiced for over 40 years, going on 50 years. It was developed by the airline industry and with
Thank
FAA
goodness.
Support. Anybody who flies on a commercial airliner in the United States or from the United States is being protected by the fact that that aircraft is being maintained in accordance with reliability-centered maintenance practices. You cannot get an aircraft certified if you haven't met the requirements for reliability-centered maintenance. If that isn't a good argument for applying it to your own assets, then there is no
And it's
no
a great,
way to,
that communicates the importance of RCM when it is, I was just thinking, I said, there's got to be a program that's applied to airlines because, well, it's catastrophic if they don't do things right.
And it was before. The predecessor to RCM, that is reliability-centered maintenance, was time-directed maintenance. And time-directed maintenance has very, very many gaps in it. And we were having very, very many aircraft crashes with jet aircraft before the jumbo jets came along. It was developed for the jumbo jets, and later on it was applied to all commercial aircraft, not just in the United States, but also in Europe. Even the Russians use reliability-centered maintenance for their aircraft. So, when we found out about it, in my case in 1971, before the seminal book that came out in 1978 described it, we adopted it for nuclear submarines. Now, up until that point, we'd lost two nuclear submarines for a variety of reasons, not including maintenance. But after that, we haven't lost any. 50 years of good performance on the nuclear submarine fleet.
Just that information alone, that data alone, would think that would encourage the C-level folks within an industry to just realize we can apply the same discipline to this asset as being applied to the airline or the submarines and so on.
Well, the argument that makes most sense to most C-level personnel is the one that says, if you understand there's a correlation between personnel safety and reliability of your assets, you would want to adopt a very solid reliability program, because no organization wants to be guilty of any kind of a safety incident that either costs injury or death of their employees. And as I say, again, there's a direct correlation between asset reliability and safety. And there's also a direct correlation between increased reliability and environmental safety. An environmental incident can rapidly cause the reputation of an organization to sink to the bottom. But if you have a high reliability program, for example, in wastewater treatment plants, you're far better off than not having it, because you're going to protect the environment much better with reliable equipment than unreliable equipment. Very simple.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and I know that at the sea level they're also looking at money. They do. That's a bottom line too, and it's.
Let's look at it from a money standpoint.
Yeah,
there's also a direct correlation between reliability and asset utilization. If you are operating your equipment to its maximum capacity and it's reliable, you're going to make more money than if you have unreliable equipment that's not available. It's not being utilized.
Okay, then I have to ask the elephant in the room is, why? I mean, what you're telling me, it's like, okay, well, that makes all sense, and it's great, it's wonderful, but we still, you've mentioned it, the challenge is the actual adoption of the program at the C level, and the opportunity is, of course, there's plenty of companies out there that would benefit from it. Why? Why? It makes complete sense to me.
It's this long, slow process to get the message to the right level. There are not a lot of CEOs at this conference, and perhaps that's the problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, I'm going to have an opportunity, I think, in sometime in early 2018 to address a conference that is attended largely by CEOs. And the arguments that I'm going to use are similar to the ones that I've used here.
Laid out.
See what the reaction is. So, and I have some very competent associates in this business, not working with me or for me, but they do have the ear of the people at sea level, and when they do, they often get the resources necessary to come in and help their organization become more reliable.
Well, Mr. Jack, thank you very much for spending. I know you're a busy man. And you've got a lot going on here at the conference. He's the trailblazer, a leader in reliability. He is a published author. You got to get it. Hey, how would anybody get a hold of you? Are you on LinkedIn?
I'm on LinkedIn.
And it's Jack Nicholas?
Nicholas, as the saint, N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S. Yeah. And it's J-D, as in Dorothy, Nicholas, at supernet.com.
Got it, at supernet. Because I got to tell you, everybody out there, you got to get a hold of this gentleman and at least have a conversation, get his books. He's got a ton of books. I've got another one in front of him. He's got a series on motor electrical predictive maintenance testing on motors. And then, of course, the other 12 books out there. Fantastic. Mr. Jack, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. I know you're busy and got this through.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure is absolutely on this side of the desk. Have a wonderful day, guys, and thank you for joining the Industrial Talk podcast. We will be right back. Wow, what an incredible honor to be able to have the opportunity to interview Mr. Jack Nicholas. I can't recommend it enough to go out there on LinkedIn, become a part of his network, find his books out there. Yeah, I know you can find his books at reliabilityweb.com because they have a ton of reliability-related books, but find this one because you can't go wrong with getting this gentleman's book. And once again, I'd like to thank the folks at reliabilityweb.com and allowing Industrial Talk Podcast to broadcast live from IMC 2017. Now, this is going to continue. We got a lot of other interviews that happened from that particular conference, all of them just industry leaders, thought people that are passionate about their reliability. And once again, if you are thinking about getting into this profession, you've got to go to the reliabilityweb.com, reach out to the people there and get that information. And finally, thank you very much for your patience and with the live broadcast. But because we're committed to education, we're committed to providing this information, we'll do whatever is necessary to bring you the best in industrial in education and information. And once again, back to reliabilityweb.com. They are fantastic people. Thank you very much for allowing Industrial Talk to broadcast. And there will be much more. Stay tuned for Mr. Jack Nicholas's number two in the series interview brought to you by a gentleman by the name of Buddy Lee. Once again, thank you and have a wonderful week.